I'm Veronica Dudo tonight on EWTN News Nightly.
Two cases regarding trans-identifying students and sports are heard by the Supreme Court today. A look at the arguments and analysis.
The House Study Committee releases a new plan to keep the government running and prevent a government shutdown. I'm Eric Rosales from Capitol Hill. I'll have the latest.
New reports from Iran say the situation is worse than previously thought. And now President Trump has a new message for the regime. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of St. Hilary Poitier, our top story tonight. The Supreme Court heard two cases today on male athletes competing in women's sports. Justices heard argument in these landmark cases that could alter the future of women's sports in the U.S.
Do you think sex in Title IX can reasonably be interpreted to allow different states to take different understandings of that in their sports leagues?
I do, because I don't...
Why is that? That's real important, I think, going forward.
Right. Because I don't think the purpose of Title IX is to have an accurate definition of sex. I think the purpose is to make sure that sex isn't being used to discriminate.
Two cases were on the docket today. The first was Little versus Hecox. Idaho bans males from participating in female sports. Lindsay Hecox, a biological male, wanted to join Boise State University's cross-country team. Hecox later filed a lawsuit saying the ban violated constitutional rights and the Equal Protection Clause. The main question, can states in alignment with the Equal Protection Clause require athletes to compete based on biological sex? The other case was West Virginia versus BPJ. West Virginia has a Save Women's Sports Act in place that requires public school and college sports teams to be designated based on biological sex. BPJ is a biological male who wanted to join a school's cross-country team. PBJ's mother filed a lawsuit saying her child's exclusion violates Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. The question here, can states designate girls and boys sports teams based on biological sex using Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause? Joining me now to discuss this further is Mary Rice Hansen, the Kate O'Byrne Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much.
So there's a lot going on. In today's landmark argument, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito pressed the attorney for the plaintiff, questioning how Idaho state law defines boy, girl, man, and woman as part of determining whether discrimination occurred. Let's take a listen.
We do not have a definition for the court, and we don't take issue with the We're not disputing the definition here. What we're saying is that the way it applies in practice is to exclude birth sex males categorically from women's teams, and that there's a subset of those birth sex males where it doesn't make sense to do so according to the state's own interest.
Well, how can a court determine whether there's discrimination on the basis of sex without knowing what sex means for equal protection purposes?
How significant is this and the repercussions it could have for America?
Well, these cases are tremendously important, but I'll tell you, Justice Alito honed right in on the core issue. What does sex mean? And is it permissible for the law to take note of differences between males and females? And for example, in sports, to permit female-only sports? And I think we can see that the way the arguments went, I think it's going to come down in the right way. I think we can be fairly confident that the court is not going to say that it is a violation of equal protection for laws to say that female-only sports must be restricted to females, that males cannot participate. I think they're going to say the same with Title IX, that Title IX does permit schools to have female-only sports. And those are important decisions. Hopefully it'll come down that way, but I think that's the way the arguments seem to be leaning.
In addition to the Alito exchange, what other points do you think will have the biggest impact on this case?
So I think one of the things that is important to notice is that the use of language is really deceptive. So the people who were suing on behalf of these athletes, these male athletes who identified as, quote, transgender, They used female pronouns. They referred to them as trans women, trans girls, as if they were some sort of a subset of females. And yet at other points in the argument, they said, no, these are a subset of males, males who no longer have that performance advantage because they have taken either blocked puberty in the West Virginia case, or they have taken estrogen in the Idaho case. So there's a lot of internal contradictions, but I think we need to pay attention to language, because even among the Supreme Court justices, we saw an unfortunate use of terms like trans girls or trans women, as if to give validity to the point that someone can be born male and yet actually be some kind of a girl. And that's just not true. That's just not true. Sex is immutable.
Now, so many people are watching this. A lot of lawmakers are weighing in. Senator Steve Daines from Montana is a dad to two daughters and the grandfather of three girls. He tells EWTN News that he wants to protect women's sports. Here's what he had to say.
I think it's going to be a good day for America. I liked what I heard in the oral arguments from the Supreme Court justices. And thank God we've got a center-right Supreme Court. And we pray and hope they'll make the right decision here in this very important case.
Ultimately, do you think the justices will be able to make a ruling without defining sex?
Well, I think what they're going to say is for Title IX purposes, sex permits female-only sports. I think because the language of Title IX permits that kind of a distinction to be drawn. I think they're also going to say under equal protection, we're not going to grant transgender status some sort of a protected status as if it's a category of its own, but rather they're going to try to analyze this. Now, whether they come up with and side with the real definition of sex as being biological, I don't know. We'll see how that writes out. But I will say one of the best moments really in the argument was, I believe it was Justice Kavanaugh, who was really pushing back on the idea that this only affects just a few athletes. These are the number of males who identify as females and who are trying to participate in female sports. It's only a few, and shouldn't we make some sort of exception? And he was really very articulate in picking up on the arguments that have pointed out that for every male who joins a team, another woman is or girl is being excluded. For every male who gets on the podium, a woman is not on that podium. So there's a lot of losses that may not be counted in terms of championships and other aspects. So it was neat. You could see his own experience, I think, in coaching his daughters coming through and just bringing some reality to that. But ultimately, I hope and am fairly confident that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing and not accord transgender status, a protected status under equal protection, but rather say that it is permissible under Title IX and under our constitutional law to make these distinctions on the basis of sex.
In this case and the previous West Virginia versus BPJ, there was much discussion on classification and equal opportunity. How does a subclassification for biological males identifying as women fall under equal protection?
Well, the claim is that the distinction made by the laws saying that males cannot be in female sports, that the justification for those laws is that the males have a competitive advantage because there is a physical difference and therefore the law would be justified. But what they're trying to do is carve out an exception that says, no, if these males have suppressed their testosterone, taken estrogen, et cetera, they no longer fit within that justification, that reason why we would say it's okay to distinguish between males and females in terms of sports. And the court really wasn't buying that, because the standard is you look at the law and you say, is there an important governmental interest? It's not a question of whether you can come up with one exception of an individual whose personal situation doesn't quite fall under the justification for the law. So that was sort of a red herring. It was an attempt to get the result they want while skirting the actual constitutional law there.
Mary Rice Hansen, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
President Donald Trump takes his economic message on the road to Michigan, talking auto plant investments, the latest inflation numbers, and tariffs. The White House says workers' wages are rising, investments are flowing into the country, and economic growth is accelerating. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Veronica, President Donald Trump said today he is standing up for the American auto worker, and that U.S. auto factories are seeing more than $70 billion of new investment.
We have tremendous growth numbers.
President Donald Trump responds to the latest economic numbers released early this morning.
The inflation numbers just came out, and we have very low inflation. So that would give Tulane Powell the chance to give us a nice, beautiful, big rate cut, which would be great.
After leaving the White House and boarding Air Force One, President Trump flew to Detroit, where he received a tour of a Ford F-150 pickup truck factory to promote U.S. manufacturing.
All of the U.S. automakers now are doing great, and before they were having a really hard time.
The president then addressed the Detroit Economic Club.
Under our administration, growth is exploding, productivity is soaring, investment is booming, incomes are rising, inflation is defeated, America is respected again like never before.
Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt adds, President Trump's powerful tariffs, massive tax cuts for working families, and sweeping deregulatory agenda have positioned our economy for a boom in 2026. Consumer prices rose 2.7% last month compared to a year earlier, but the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party criticizes President Trump, writing, after spending months claiming that affordability was a hoax and creating a health care crisis for Michiganders, Donald Trump is now coming to Detroit, a city he hates, to tout his billionaire first agenda while working families suffer.
But we're already growing double, triple, and even quadruple the speed of almost every other major economy on Earth. We're the number one economy on Earth, too. And the results are in, and the Trump economic boom is officially begun.
In his speech today, President Trump also said his tariffs, now before the U.S. Supreme Court, are making money for Michigan, and that the nation is stronger, safer, and richer because of them. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Joining us now is Patrick Horan, Chief Operating Officer with the Fiscal Lab on Capitol Hill. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, how would you characterize the state of the U.S. economy?
The state of the U.S. economy, it's a little unclear how things are overall. You can always, sometimes that's true to some extent all the time. I would say we had some inflation numbers that came out today that were encouraging in the sense that they suggest inflation is trending downward. However, they're still high relative to where the Fed wants inflation to be. The Fed's goal is to have inflation at 2%. Right now, it's more at 2.7%, which is down from where it was before, but it's still high. That's the on the inflation side. On other parts of the economy, we've had some mixed signals. For instance, the GDP numbers we've had for the past few quarters, that looks at total income across the economy, those have been looking very good. On the other hand, job market data has actually been kind of weak. We've seen sluggish job growth over the past several months, which is not great. So you kind of have some contradictory signals coming from GDP and employment. So it makes it kind of hard to assess where we are right now.
President Trump's visit to Detroit comes as the new report shows inflation cooled slightly, as you mentioned last month. So how's Main Street and Wall Street reacting?
I haven't looked at the stock market today. In general, the stock markets have been doing fairly well, so I don't think Wall Street is panicking or anything. And as I mentioned, on Wall Street, it's a bit of a mix. I mean, even people on Main Street, they have 401ks, they do care about what the stock market is looking like, so they're happy about that. Job growth has not been great. Unemployment rate is okay. It hasn't gone up a lot. So we're in this kind of this funny state where there's not much job creation. People are just staying in their jobs generally. They're not moving either.
Now, President Trump has also recently stressed the importance of affordability, announcing policies to drive down the cost of everyday goods. How will these policies impact Americans?
Well, the president recently suggested that he wants to ban what are called institutional investors, those are corporate investors or big investors, from buying single-family homes. And the idea there is that he's concerned that these institutional investors are snatching up homes and then they're charging high rents to renters and they're making it harder for people to buy houses, that they're driving up the price of housing. I think the real big problem with housing is we have a supply problem. It's too hard to build more houses. We need to build more houses. That would lower prices more, in my view.
And what are your thoughts about President Trump wanting credit card companies to lower interest rates?
Again, sure, the president's frustration. I'm a little bit concerned that if there's just a price control on that, it's actually going to squeeze off access to credit for people who otherwise wouldn't afford it. And you're probably familiar that credit card companies offer things like bonus points if people would be able, bonus points would likely be cut if they didn't, if they wouldn't have the profits that they get from interest. Now, I agree that interest rates are very high, though. So how could you bring down interest rates, bring down inflation further? We've seen a little bit of progress on that front, as I mentioned. Also, when the federal government spends lots of money it doesn't have and drives up deficits, that puts upward pressure on interest rates. I think bringing deficits under control and reducing them, getting closer to a balanced budget, that would help with interest rate pressure.
Patrick Horan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
House Republicans on the study committee say they have a plan to save American families money and take on the affordability issues head on. They unveiled their own government funding bill today. It's all part of the Republicans' new focus on kitchen table issues in this election year. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with what's inside the new reconciliation bill. Eric?
Well, good evening, Veronica. Yes, House Republicans rolled out their plan today titled Making the American Dream Affordable Again. They claim it's an extension of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which passed out of the GOP-controlled Congress last summer. Now, the Republican study committee members say that the bill is a combination of many bills being introduced and combined into one bill. They claim that it will reverse the economic damage done to families by the Biden administration.
So now Republicans are spending the next 3 years, starting now, making the American dream affordable again. And it would be political malpractice if we did not pursue a reconciliation 2.0.
The American people gave us unified Republican leadership, gave us Donald Trump, a new CEO, competent leadership. They want common sense policies, and they want to be able to feed their families and pay the bills.
The bill focuses on several areas. It reforms Obamacare with tighter restrictions but lowers costs. Subsidies go directly to patients through health freedom accounts, codifies the Trump RX program to lower drug costs, and expands access to paid family leave. Other policies include it prohibits federal funding for illegal aliens enrolled in Medicaid, permanently bars federal funding for large abortion providers, and prohibits Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies for transgender surgeries. It also eliminates the capital gains tax and includes proposals designed to make it easier to buy a home. House Speaker Mike Johnson says it will impact families directly.
We wanted to make life more affordable again for American families. We wanted to reduce that cost of living, particularly lower and middle class earners, who really did take it on the chin over the 4 years of the Biden administration.
Democrats say it's a bill filled with Republicans' far-right policies and gimmicks.
The House right now is nothing more than a reckless rubber stamp under Republican leadership for Donald Trump's extreme policies, and the American people know it. It's one of the reasons why Republicans are being routed all across the country.
If this is just a project that Republicans want to do to make themselves look good so they can say that they're talking about health care, count us out. If this cuts costs that their billionaire friends have to pay and reduces taxes, count us out.
With no guarantees that Republicans will be able to keep the House after the midterm elections, they want to try and get this over the finish line as fast as they can. But Senate Majority Leader John Thune is skeptical about another reconciliation package. However, both chambers must first pass a budget before they can move forward on any funding bills, which still hasn't happened just yet. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Tension is mounting in Iran as the death toll from nationwide protests has skyrocketed to at least 2,000 people. What began as anger over a collapsing economy has transformed into the deadliest challenge to the regime in decades. The protests have now spread to all 31 provinces and over 180 cities. Despite a severe internet blackout, activists report that over 2,000 protesters have been killed in just 2 weeks. Authorities have only recently begun to ease some phone restrictions, allowing the first look into the scale of the crackdown. President Donald Trump pledged his support today to those demonstrating against the regime. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, taking President Trump to court, why two states are suing to stop what they call a federal invasion. And Pope Leo is honoring one of the world's most beloved saints in a special way this year. We have the details ahead. Welcome back. Officials say Russia has launched another major drone and missile attack on Ukraine, targeting power facilities in the country. In the northeastern city of Kharkiv, four people were killed and six were injured when a postal service building was struck during Russian attacks overnight. Rescuers pulled at least 30 people from the rubble of the building. The Russian strikes knocked out heat and power, exposing millions to extremely cold temperatures. And this morning, a Russian assault left Ukraine's capital without power. Turning now to France, where farmers are taking their anger to the streets. More than 350 tractors rolling through Paris, protesting low incomes, rising costs, and an EU trade deal with South America. Farmers say the deal could flood the market with cheaper imports, threatening France's food security. Formal approval for the deal is set to begin next week. Minnesota and Illinois are officially taking the Trump administration to court. State officials filed separate lawsuits to stop what they're calling a federal invasion by ICE and Border Patrol agents. The legal move follows the death of Renee Nicole Good, who was involved in a shooting with a federal officer in Minneapolis last week. Local leaders, including Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, claim the deployments are politically motivated and violate state sovereignty and the Constitution. The states are asking federal judges to immediately halt these operations. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has said immigration agents are targeting illegal migrants and that further agents are needed to ensure their safety during operations. Joining us today is David Super, a professor of law at Georgetown University. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Does any president of the U.S. have the legal authority to send federal agents to a state for immigration enforcement?
Yes, if it's limited to immigration enforcement, that is one of the powers of the federal government. The concern here is that these agents are going way beyond immigration enforcement.
If an administration is enforcing the law set by the U.S. Congress, should protesters be voicing their concerns to lawmakers on Capitol Hill instead?
Well, there's no either or. If people see something in their community that is disturbing them, the First Amendment guarantees them the right to protest that. And they also, under the First Amendment, have the right to contact their members of Congress and ask for change.
Where do you see these lawsuits going?
Well, the lawsuits are challenging the intrusion of these agencies, but they're also challenging a lot of their particular practices. They're saying that the constitutional right against unreasonable search and seizures is being frustrated when these officers are confronting and often arresting U.S. citizens and other people without reasonable suspicion. So I suspect these lawsuits will end up giving us a lot clearer rules about how these agents can operate than we've had up to this point.
It also seems that in the lawsuits, a lot of the conversation is around the number of federal agents being sent to the states. What is the legality of this?
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution about the numbers that they may send. The question is the effect. And the states are arguing that the enormous numbers, the so-called surges in Illinois and Minnesota, are displacing local law enforcement, are spending lots and lots of local resources cleaning up after the problems that the federal agents leave behind. There's one story in there about them arresting someone out of a car in the middle of the road and not even putting the car into park, so the car goes rolling down the road and local police have to do something about it. The argument is that we can't do the functions of local police if we're having to deal with all these problems caused by federal overreach.
As federal agents enforce the current immigration laws with tactics they've been trained to carry out, should a broader conversation be about changes to such protocols?
Yes, and I think that's what these two states are trying to stimulate here, is trying to say, we understand that there needs to be immigration enforcement, but a lot of this stuff strikes us as going way beyond immigration enforcement, and a lot of this stuff is interfering with people's constitutional rights.
David Super, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, another jubilee, how Pope Leo is honoring one of the church's most beloved saints. Just days after the Jubilee Year of Hope wrapped up in Rome, Pope Leo XIV declares a Franciscan Jubilee Year. It commemorates the 800th anniversary of the death of St. Francis of Assisi. The Jubilee was inaugurated this week and runs until January 2027. The faithful can gain a plenary indulgence by making a pilgrimage to any conventional Franciscan church. It's January 13th, and today the church celebrates St. Hilary of Poitiers. St. Hilary was born in Poitiers, France, in the 4th century. He was raised a pagan but converted to Christianity after studying the scriptures. Reluctantly, he became Bishop of Poitiers and fiercely defended the faith against the major heresy of the age known as Arianism. It denied the divinity of Jesus Christ. So ardent was Hilary's defense of the church's teachings on Christ and also the Trinity, that he was nicknamed the Hammer of the Arians and was later named a Doctor of the Church. St. Hilary, pray for us. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.